discover that it wasn't meant, and that if you want to differentiate between church and church, then you use church as institution and church as those who embrace Jesus, whoever he is. We'll find out about him later on again. I love you. Now, since the audience at this point is all white, with the exception of one in the balcony, or maybe one or two more that may drift in, my wife, maybe one or two of my children, you then connotes, it means white people. Now, that's a pretty difficult thing for us to deal with, too, because I think that when I say, I love you, he loves me. Groovy, you know. But then there's a real trick in this, too, you see, because there are some questions which precede that, which you've got to ask and which you've got to come up with answers to. We know who you are. That is, black people know who white people are. Question is, do white people know who they are? Do they know? Do they know whom we are loving? Those are the questions. So if you'll just remember those during the discussion, we can deal with some of those a little better after you've told me who you are. This is a swimming pool, or a jacuzzi, or a sauna. Pick one. And there are people in there. Have been for a long time. Here's a mud puddle. Now, since the good ship Jesus landed in this country, by the way, the good ship Jesus is the name of the ship that brought over a lot of black people, slaves. Since the good ship Jesus landed in this country, some games have been played, and the games were being played between those who inhabited the mud puddle and those who inhabited the swimming pool. Every morning about daybreak, one or two would come up to the mud puddle. Hey, can I come in? No, you can't. Oh, come on, let me in, won't you? No, you can't. Oh, we wanna swim and play too. We wanna enjoy what you enjoy. We want to be like you. No, you can't. And in order to communicate this campness a little more, you see, some fences went up. And so they would, you know, like talk through the fences, you know, can we? No, you can't. Can we? No, you can't. We want to. No, you don't. You know. And so finally, then, wholesale frustration sets in. But you see, while all this dialogue is going on, this pool is filling up with a lot of silt and stuff. A lot of filth. A lot of bacteria. Quite beautiful too. And it was going into the ground, see? And it was infecting the mud puddle even more than it was infected, you see. And so the group here, preoccupied with getting here, wasn't really understanding what was happening even to their mud puddle. In other words, you don't miss your water till your well runs dry. You don't know what a good thing you've got, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, then somebody down here said, hey, y'all, we got something good here. You know, what are we going to do with that? Well, we're going to stop going up here. We're just going to stop going up here. And we're going to stop playing games. We don't want to play the game anymore. So we will develop our own pool. And we'll build some real neat things here, Look, Vic, you're the engineer. I'm really sorry to betray my ignorance at this point, but anyway, if I should go afoul of good engineering feats here, help me, okay? And we'll even put in some, you know, we'll put in our own little filtering thing, you know, so that this won't get contaminated anymore, and we're going to work on this, and we know that it's going to be better than this, because after all, this one is filling up with crap. See? And then they're wondering why we don't want to play in it anymore. Aren't you going to come up and play anymore? No. We'll even let you play on your terms now, and not on ours. No. We're going to develop our thing. And then finally somebody says, hey, you know, it's getting kind of smelly up here. Can we come? Well, all right. Here it is. Now you're going to play on our terms. Because what we've got is better than what you had, because what you had was something that systematically disenfranchised and dispossessed this. And the oppressors and the dispossessors always end up with something that's a lot worse than they thought they had. So we're on a collision course in this country, and I think that the picture's clear. And that collision course is between two things. It is between black pride and white racism. And the gap is slowly but surely closing. Because the two are irreconcilable. White pride, maybe, but certainly not white racism. Now we want that picture to stand for a moment. From the time that all of us popped out of our mothers, we're on a line. And at the end of that line, there is another little box, and it's called a coffin. Those who get on this line and stay on it are doing what we call living straight. And it's a sort of a thing that's communicated at least from the young to the old about straight people, you see. Those who are living straight are those who are on this line. Now there are some, however, who have tried to figure out whether or not God, in his all-wise providence, intended for man to live straight. Now there are certain examples of from the Bible itself, and we'll get to those when I go over to Sitar, would suggest just the opposite, but let me just do this. So there are human beings who say, we will dream. And we will dream dreams unlike any dreams that have ever been dreamt before. We will dream dreams of touching and being touched by people. We will dream dreams of living out a prophetic style which defies the law of logic. We will dream dreams which are diametrically opposed to the dreams that have been dreamt, the dreams here. Pretty much expressed in songs like Tiki Taki and others. And so we'll get off this line. And we will dream. Now there's a terrific habit in doing this, because up here there's somebody who has reached this level who says no, and so you get pushed down again. But you say, no, I ain't going to stay there. I'm going to go up. And then you say, oh, this is as far as you can go. No, back down you go. Well, no, I can't quite buy the fact that I've long gone. Here, whoops, can't really make it through. Okay, here we are again. We'll try again. Oops, here we go. Well, eventually the dreamer gets there too. But behold how long the line is, you see. 33 years. Of living. 33 years of being touched and of touching. That's a reasonable facsimile of the old rugged cross. So eventually you get to the box. Eventually you make it where everybody makes it, including those who live straight. But the line is longer, and certainly a lifetime has been packed into that sort of style, and that's called living crooked, you see. And a man could get killed that, you see. Man could get killed being possessed by dreams and attempting to possess. And that's why young people in some of their songs and in some of their expressions have said things like, he was a failure at 33. So now we're going to talk about the failure.
For those of you who are not familiar with it, one of the prime resources for this particular discussion, and it's not going to be a theological treatise, you know, or a lecture at this point, it's called Black Theology and Black Power. It's by James Cone, May 69, Seabury. This particular book now will become undoubtedly what the manifesto was for the Bolshevik thing, the Black Revolt. And for the first time in the history of the Black existence in this country, the style of the Black preacher and the style of the Black Christian is resurrected. It is not a new style, it is not a new concept, it's a very old one. And it's one which comes from, if you will, the Black Church pre-emancipation, or that period known as slavery. The tradition of the Black preacher, as is expressed in this particular work, is a tradition which is very old, very dear to us. And there are certain challenges built into this and certain frightening aspects, but I don't want you to get so frightened or feel so guilty that you can't discuss with me sensibly after we've closed. This is the third time that we've attempted to do this. We're doing it just a little bit different for some of those who have been involved in the discussions before. But here we got a we got to do it again and again and again so that it comes clear, obviously. The concept of freedom lies at the center of Black people's yearning in this country. Now, when I say freedom now, this freedom does not mean, as has meant for lots of people, freedom to do what you want to do, but freedom to be what you are. And being what you are is best expressed in words which are not antithetical to freedom, but which mean obviously the same thing. Self-determination, self-identity. the ability to give assent, if you will, to the presence of your God in Jesus, in your context. Another little word, a word that some people are attempting to throw out, is the word isness. All are words which mean basically the same thing. These are expressions of what we mean when we talk about freedom. Becoming what I should, which means destroying utterly that which prevents me from becoming or being what I should be. Eradicating, if you will, those things which are in conflict with my isness. Why did God go through the trouble, and here we ask the question again, the trouble of becoming man? What was this madness? This madness expressed in the lifestyle of the wandering Jew, who from the very, very first breath of life he took, started to express and to live a style that was different from the norm. The first announcement of his birth being to men who smelled of sheep. The announcement of his birth going across burning sands and somehow capturing the imagination of kings who were black. His growing up in the unpretentious confines of a carpenter's shop. His whole life, if you will, surrounded by the sort of meanness which only those who have identified with the oppressed and the dispossessed can understand. What means this madness? Well, the scripture passage which we use here is Galatians 5:1, and there are others. For freedom, Christ has set us free. Now, it seems to me that the prophet in exile, Isaiah, kind of puts his finger on it, at least Jesus said that he did, when in Isaiah 61, the words go, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach glad tidings to the poor, to preach freedom to those who are in prison, to declare freedom for those who are systematically disenfranchised and dispossessed, to pour oil into the wounds of those that have been cut with the sword, to bind up the broken arms of those who've been overrun with chariots or automobiles, as the case might be, to declare the acceptable year of the Lord." Now, that's a sort of liberal translation of Isaiah 61. Jesus, when he starts his ministry, walks into the temple, and he picks up the book of the prophet and he reads from it. And after he finishes his reading, he closes the book and he looks around at the people who are in the church. And he says, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." And then he goes out where the action is and proceeds, as the brothers and sisters on the street say, to do business. And this business is the sort of business that we want to try and talk about a little bit. Black people understand this style. Not only black people, but those who enjoy, if you will, the black condition understand this style. And here now, so that you understand where we're going, we somehow skip over certain things which are needed here to define what we're talking about, basically because we haven't come up with the sort of definitions which meet with the approval of everybody. That's upon y'all, you know. Black folks are hardly looking for anybody's approval anymore. We're much more arrogant, self-sufficient, egotistical than that. I think that's quite obvious now. But we talk about blackness in two concepts. One, blackness as it connotes a state of the mind, which is the big concept and the most important one, and blackness as it connotes skin color. And if one understands, how many of you have seen Franz Fanon's work, The Wretched of the Earth, Hands? It's in the library over here, so I'd suggest if you haven't seen it, pick it up and try and read through it a little bit. Franz Fanon is a French Algerian psychoanalyst. He's black, and he lived during the Algerian Revolt. And he committed some of his case studies to print, and he's got essays which follow in other books like White Skin, Black Skin, White Masks, and others. But he developed and pioneered in a thing that's not too new anymore, the concept of the third world. Third world being those who are not of the first two worlds. First two worlds being those worlds which are represented by the two capitals of the universe, if you will, Moscow and Washington, D.C. And so those who are of the third world are those who are not either communistic, Russian style, or capitalistic, American style. These are the, quotes, underdeveloped, underprivileged nations of the world, primarily presented in blackness, in brownness, in yellowness, and in redness. Redness as it connotes the original Americans, the nations which inhabited this world, and redness as it connotes those who are Indians in India and parts of Asia and what have you. So that's this is what we mean when we talk about third world. Now there are also white people included in this. Many of them don't know that they are yet. If you want examples of that, we can use the examples of the Appalachians, of the those who have a rather unique lifestyle, unique modes of expression, and those who are being used by U.S. Steel and other people. Johnny Cash, if you're familiar with him, is one of those who best presents, if you will, in song and in style, the white folk who are unequivocally members of the third world. So that's how we use the concept of blackness. The oppressed of the world and of the nation. Now we're gonna try and confine much of our thinking, however, to either side of both oceans here, because I've got a real hang-up about trying to solve problems over there before we get at some of them here. And this is a thing which I'm not real good at doing. I talk about it, but I'm not good at suggesting too many answers. The gospel is God with us now, doing battle against evil, those things which enslave and oppress and dehumanize people. That's the gospel. The gospel, as Jack Elliott would describe it, is good news for a bad condition. It is that force which does more than say, but it is that force which does liberating acts. And it's quite consistent in doing that. And so the gospel now, as it's understood in black theology, and as it's understood in black Christendom in total, is the liberation of the oppressed people from the oppressor by any means necessary and consistent with, appropriate to, that gospel. By any means necessary is a phrase which comes from Malcolm. Now, because of the peculiar circumstances under which black people were trapped like animals and brought to this country, and because of the ways in which black people and others have had to survive in this country, one must then operate with the understanding that black people understand what they need to be liberated from. And what they need to be liberated from is described in the Bible and described best by Jesus. One example, of course, is his encounter with the devil, if you will, in the wilderness, and how he declared his freedom from that sort of nonsense, if you will. Now, a part of the problem, as I said on Sunday, is that the Christian church has gone through a period of naming the gods. Who art thou, O Lord? And who art thou, O Christ? Etc., etc., etc. Well, without really receiving the answer when it came, you see. And so the naming of the gods period now must be replaced by another period, and that period, and here we move down to who are you, and black people are in a position at this point to at least create a climate where white people can indulge themselves not in a mad search, but in a search for their identity. And there are several ways in which the black preacher does this, and the black preacher's style is no different from the style of Jesus. One of them is called the put-on. Now, a lot of folks recoil at the idea of being put on. That's understandable because they had that same problem with Jesus, you know. He was famous or infamous for using the put on. Lord, this man is a terrible fellow. He has offended me time and time again. How many times should I forgive this lousy character? And so the Lord says, well, I've forgiven him 7 times already, the man adds. The Lord says, well, forgive him 70 times 7, which comes to 491. Now, the Swedish people made a movie about that. It's called 491. If you're ever in a town that tolerates underground movies, check it out. It's very interesting. 491 times. Okay, that's one example. And of course, another man comes on with the same kind of rhetoric, and Jesus answers, well, you know, you can't really see the speck that's in your brother's eye when you've got a plank in your own. Elton Trueblood says, and he dedicated a book to his little children. It's called The Humor of Christ. And he dedicates this book to his little children, whom he says knew when to laugh. And he was reading this particular passage at the table for devotions, and the little children just broke out in a big laugh, you see, which is something that you don't find in churches too much. Holden is kind of peculiar in that respect. We laugh at Vespers and things now because we understand a bit of the humor of the preacher. You know, preachers have had an awful time being funny. You know, sometimes we've had to resort to quotes, risque jokes in order to evoke laughter from people, but we couldn't evoke that sort of laughter by using pictures of Jesus or even biblical language. But anyway, Trueblood's children laughed, and so this really ticked him off, and he went through the whole Bible then, picking out jokes that Jesus told. It's a fascinating little book, Humor of Christ, Elton Trueblood. Check that one out too. This helps you to understand a little bit of the person of Jesus. Ludwig has a thing about this, and he'll do something about it when he does the Trinity. Now I'm going to cut off three paragraphs of my thing out of deference to the kindly old gentleman over there who has something else to say about Jesus too. Jesus then came into the world to destroy the works of Satan, the devil, to eliminate once and for all the demonic which possessed the lives of people. We are in a position now to describe the demonic in the USA or America, represented in Washington and in other places. The demonic is not black. It is not red. It is not yellow. It is not brown. Now that doesn't leave too many colors, does it? And so we believe that Malcolm was correct when he described the man for us. And he described the man as the blue-eyed white devil. Now, I always use the word unfortunately at this point because it is unfortunate that my Christianity came to me through this thing. And I was listening to Paul Haynes' tape again this morning, and he again talked about how convenient it is to have Negroes in the Lutheran Church, especially if they are the kind who have denied their blackness and affirmed whiteness. And I remember, and I'll repeat these again too, statements which were used when we were converted, that is, when the gospel was brought to us, masks of benignity carved in ebony, who inhabited the dusty and hot confines of little hovels in Alabama and in Mississippi and in Georgia and in Florida and North and South Carolina and what have you. The fields are white for the harvest. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he would send forth laborers into his harvest. That is, pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he would raise up missionaries who would collect the spiritual scalps of these masks of benignity carved in ebony. Wash them and make them as white as the new fallen snow. So very early, some of us became terribly suspicious of that sort of Christianity. And one understands why the suspicion, once one starts to understand the strained and twisted, the perverted, if you will, fouled up color schemes, the way they were used to edify some and to denigrate others. And so we ask questions about not your Jesus, but about Jesus. And there's a difference in the way we understand him. There's a difference in the way in which he is pictured in our community. And certainly a difference in the way in which his style, his lifestyle, is understood. Is it possible to be really black, and still identify with the traditions expressed in Western Christianity? Is it possible to be really black and accept Solomon's portrayal of Jesus, or even Leonardo da Vinci's depicting of all of the biblical characters? Is it possible to be black and accept that? Martin King, and I remember in a smoke-filled room one night, he agonized over this because one of the more innovative blacks posed a question. Why is it that Moses is always picked up when he starts across the Red Sea? Isn't there something else in the history of Moses as the liberator of his people that folks don't want to be reminded of too much? Isn't it true that Moses was visiting this certain area one day, maybe to go out and look for his adopted father, Ramesses? If that wasn't his name, then he's going to be Ramesses right now. Isn't it true that he beheld an Egyptian pig beating his people? And isn't it true that Moses looked this way and that way, and he did the Egyptian pig in and buried him in the sand? Well, one wonders whether or not Moses had demonstrated at Pharaoh's house, whether he had carried placards, whether he had written petitions, whether he had followed the traditional redress of grievance tactics which so many folks have done. Well, then we don't want to stay there too much, because then that gets us into real trouble, and it's too much fuel for the fire, some say. We go back to Jesus. Moses' frustration, as was the frustration of many of the other people, Amos, for example, who got a chance to preach one sermon because he had something on his mind for the good church people, was really taken care of in Christ because he was born. He did become man. And so now we're stuck with a question. If Jesus, as a result of God in his infinite wisdom determining this, became a Jew when he did, those of us then who divorce ourselves from the search for the historical Jesus and who talk about him as he is now, must ask, what is he ethnically? Who is he, including his color, his style, and what have you? Where is he located? Where did you find him when contrasting, if you will, those who thought that they could take him piggyback into the areas where grass was green and birds were singing, and they could confine him to those things that take up space called churches? Is he or isn't he with the oppressed people? Is he or isn't he doing battle against the oppressor? Well, black people then say that Jesus is with the oppressed, always, and never with the oppressor. And there are certain words and examples from the life of Jesus, which I won't get into now, but which I'm sure you will at least start to understand, which do more than suggest this. You're either for me or against me. You are either for the oppressed, i.e. with the oppressed, or you are against them. You cannot be both. There is no gray area, if you will, no warm spot, no just right condition when one embraces Christ. It is either one or the other. So we want to just deal with that now for a few moments. Okay? No, I'm not going to try and evoke responses from you. Silence to me is not so deafening that one does not understand that people are thinking. So if you don't want to talk, don't. But if there are some of you who are like afraid to break the silence and who have some questions, please go right ahead.
I'd like to make some statements rather than ask a question.
Okay, Ludwig.
The artistic work of all Christians has always pictured Christ in his image. I have a book in my place there, Christ in by Chinese artists, and the Christ and all the figures of the Bible are depicted definitely as yellow, slant-eyed Orientals. So your question, whether you are forced to accept the blue-eyed, the blonde-locked concept of Christ is, in my opinion, quite wrong. I personally am somewhat revulsed by this picture, and quite apart from the fact that Christ was Asiatic, was not European. We have adopted European Christianity from an artistic point into this country, and now we worship the production of Leonardo and if you please, and something like this. Nobody forces you to do that. If you want to develop your own black art, depict Christ and the world and so on as true black people, as I have seen it in beautiful carving, nobody prevents you. But that's purely artistic work, ultimate. It has nothing to do with religion.
Well, let's explore for a minute, Ludwig, whether or not this is true. You see, I think that the chronicles of history, you know, of this country, present certain facts. For example, if it were not compatible with Christian symbols, it was destroyed. Even, you know, pictures which were repulsive to white people of Christ, rejected. Consequently, the publishing houses, you know, and those who do Sunday school material and stuff like this have really, really done irreparable damage to the ability of black, not so now, you know, because we don't have any white Jesuses hanging in our house. Those are symbols of the oppressor. The white Christ is in fact not the Christ, but the Antichrist. The Christ who is for the oppressor, as opposed to the Christ who is for oppressed people. He is black, and he has thick lips, and he has a broad nose, and he's got kinky hair, and other characteristics of black people. I am, and of course I've been to Haiti, and I've seen Haitian art. It's terribly racist, in my opinion. Yeah, you see, Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper, for example, giant mural in this one little museum, Everybody is black in the Muriel. You know, it's a carbon copy of Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper. But the only person who's white there is Judas, you see. The rest are black. Now, if...
Leonardo didn't depict Judas.
No, he sure didn't. He didn't, but the Haitian people did. So what we're trying to say is that it seems to me that a country where people refuse to melt, if you will, and a church, because you can't melt people, you know, and a church that is allegedly serving, you know, and ministering to diverse cultures should not require that all give assent to the same color schemes as it. I would suggest that the institutional church in this country, Western Christianity here on these shores, have followed pretty much the same basic pattern as the institution of government. And the whole commercial institution, you see. And nobody is aware of the fact that this is not a white world anymore. They're good guys because they wear white hats, you see. What does blackness connote as opposed to whiteness? Now, what black people are saying, black people are not saying no to white people. They're not even saying no to Jesus as he is pictured. What they are saying, however, is yes to black people, which is always interpreted as no to white people, which is a hang-up that white people have, and not black people.
Very well. I was at a retreat once, and it was sort of a group like this about 5 years ago, and. A friend of mine had two piles of postcards, and one was is it Solomon Christ?
Solomon,
yeah. Yeah, Solomon. And the other one was done in a totally different style, sort of, but it was very dark. The whole card was dark, and you could see the man's ribs, and you could see sort of an emaciated face, and outlined in black, dark. And the group separated off into little groups of about 10. There were 10 groups of 10. And they were given, among other things, one card of each of these and told to pass around, and they were supposed to report which of these Christs they liked better and why. And I'm not saying anything, but 9 groups wanted the pretty Christ. 9 groups wanted the pretty Christ. And only one chose the other.
Yeah, there's a very, very interesting portrait of Christ on the wall back here. Now, somehow that is not repulsive to me. It does not bother me because that is the way Jesus is, you know, that's the way he is. Question of, and let's, you know, let's not deal so much with the picture as we ought to deal with the concept. Is he oppressed or isn't he? Is he not with the oppressed people or isn't he? Is he aligning himself with the oppressor? Who are the oppressed? I don't care if it rain or freezes, let me have my plastic Jesus. the little figurines which adorn the dashboards and which hang in the homes are all for the oppressed people symbols of the Antichrist.
Well, we
would like to do that, you know. And I can't make any promises here at this point, and I know that there's a question which follows that, you know, what happens when black people are in the position, you know, to oppress. Well, as a Christian, you know, I'm always with oppressed people. You see, it just so happens now, you know, that the presentation of the oppressed, you know, of the crucified, and the continual crucifixion, you know, is a totally different picture from the picture that Western Christians have. As we see it,
you know,
we cannot. I don't think that we can dismiss, if you will, the visible topographies of what Jesus is anymore. We have been doing this. I know I have. Little black children who come into my house become quite violent, if you will. That's not Jesus. That is not Jesus. How dare you call him Jesus?
Well, what you say about the art and how is very true. I know working in some of the liturgy in the Sunday school materials in India for 10 years, of course, in every mission field, it has been propagated by white money from our church. In every part of the world, we have been given tons of pictures, of course. And the picture of Jesus with the children, the little white one is sitting on his lap, and the other children on the periphery outside. And we have seen this, and we know this is wrong, in the Indian church that I was supposed to think, but of course we're becoming aware of this. And this, of course, is because the money has been sent to publishing companies or being. And it's a matter of the whole thing, but I think our concept of what Jesus looks like and the symbol will be certainly kind of relevant because it's a symbol. It's not what's on the wall, not what we carry in our cars. It's how we portray Christ's symbol in the things we do and say. So I think that it's totally unimportant.
But it isn't, though.
I would agree.
What he looks like will be portrayed in our lives.
It is very simple for white people to say that's not important, you know. However, and I agree 100%. But there is something symptomatic, you know, in those expressions, which we've got to deal with. We've got to deal with, and it has something to do with the concept, you know, that comes from inside.
If that helps them portray the thing. In our lives, yes, I would say it's
important. Right.
But does it?
No, it doesn't. I would agree. But does it not display some of the cause behind the effect that Jesus has had? You see, Jesus, as he has been presented by the missionary enterprise, is no more than a neocolonialist. Would you agree?
No, it's an imperialistic Christianity. We
yes.
What happens with you with the other images of white in the Bible? Whiter than snow. White as a symbol of purity and perfection.
Well, I would agree that those images are perfectly acceptable. However, there are other images of white which are not so good. And they have something to do with racial encounters, if you will. I used earlier the example of Miriam's uptightness with Moses, you know, because he married a black woman. How dare you, Moses, you know, align yourself with that thing, that Ethiopian woman. And so the Bible reports that the Lord, too, was a bit distraught, not with Moses, but with Miriam. And he said, Miriam, I'll show you what whiteness is. And so he afflicted her with a terrible case of leprosy. Terrible case of leprosy. Some of us have done some study on a little passage from Solomon, Song of Solomon. She is black but comely. Now, one doesn't have to subject the word comely to any varying degrees of color test to determine that it means beautiful. Well, what means the but in there, you see? It means very simply that she is beautiful in spite of her blackness. However, the Hebrew word is translated more often and than but. She is black and beautiful. Why did the King James people have to put the but in there, you see? Now, if, for example, whiteness and blackness had been presented equally, both symbolizing the condition of man, Luther's thing, summa justus et peccator, you know, saint and sinner at the same time. However, the saint is always white. The sinner is always black, like devil's food cake and angel's food cake. You see.
The black Christ could be presented in a way that would be totally inadequate, both artistically and theologically. It seems to me that there's an aspect of revelation here that is often ignored. Christ's own words about his own reality, where he says, inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. His identification, not with the person who is ministering or who is witnessing, but with the object of ministry, or with the person that is being reached.
That's right. I agree with you. And here we move into what I call the black condition, which has nothing to do with skin color, but which has to do with a condition.
And when
I talk about Christ as being the black Christ, I'm not necessarily relegating Christ to black skin color. You see, Christ is inside of, working with, the black condition and doing battle against the white condition, if you will. That's what his life was all about. Prostitutes, publicans, thieves, you know, the very scum of society, you see. Now pick, you know, a color which depicts the lowest, the most ignorant, the most dirty, the out of it, you know, section of society. Which color do you pick? Which, you know, how would you describe that condition? Black, right?
But that doesn't refer to the color of the skin, though.
Certainly it does not. It refers to the condition.
Right.
But the color is still there, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Black.
When you speak of the oppressed, the black, are you including the criminal, the convict, the
yes.
mental patient?
Yes. Yes.
Well,
Jesus spoke of them as the prostitutes. You know, let's just run it to its logical end.
One almost feels guilty in being white. And how can we become brothers in Christ if we feel guilty being white and have to be defensive about being white?
Well, Jesus would say, take up your cross, blackness, you know, and follow me to the black condition.
The thing is, I think it doesn't make a bit of difference whether, you know, like feeling guilty. You just stop to think about feeling guilty that you're white. You know, like it's feeling guilty because you're a sinner. You know, now what the wretched man that I am, if I ran around the rest of my life feeling guilty, you know, in a kind of a way that that wouldn't allow me to be myself, to have my isness, and to respond in action. It doesn't make any difference, I don't think, whether it's, you know, feeling guilty about blackness or, you know, because you should feel guilty about sinfulness. Also,
how about the blacks the same then? They should feel guilty for sinfulness. Well, and then color becomes a barrier, which it is.
Yeah, but we're dealing with whiteness right now, and this is the sickness. And we're not, you know. It's easy for you to talk about that.
Hey, what if you took a gin and a gapping out of your plastic and filled it with water and you just sit there with no color? And if they like it,
you
turn every color
to black. Well, groovy, you know. I'm not opposed to, you know, to casting Jesus in that light.
But you know, the art has and has been used in history to study civilizations, and there are many civilizations that we can't find any of their writings or things, and we have to go by their art. And I think that art is symbolic and symptomatic of the society in which it lives in. And in this case, I do think that our society has presented a white Christ, which I myself have reacted against as an artist. And this is one of the things that I hoped to work on, is people's interpretations of this Solomon Christ and many of the other sick symbols that I think we have. And in this case, I think the emergence of a black Christ, the emergence of other symbols of Christ in our society today among the young artists and poets and people like this are symbolic of a new direction, a new thing that's happening.
Yeah, there are a group of young white artists, and I'm sure all of you have seen them. They have a concept of Christ which I at first found a bit repulsive before I started to understand Jesus a little better. It's a wanted poster. How many of you have seen that? It's a wanted poster. And Jesus, and here he's pictured, you know, and all of the things that he is wanted for are listed, you know. The same charges that were leveled against him, you know, at his trial. Here he is, presented for what he was, you know.
At the end of World War I, there was a picture which caused an unending storm of outrage and controversy. Christ on the cross with the gas mask.
Yes, 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 I remember that one.
Most powerful.
Very powerful, very powerful.
Two questions, Will. We've got to shove off with this next bus. I'm sorry, the week is too short. One, and you can maybe just make it kind of brief. Number one, you say we're on a collision course. All right, now, if we're on a collision course, what can we as at least who call ourselves Christian and hope that we've caught a vision of him, what can we do to prevent the Holocaust that would follow if the collision takes place? Is it too late in the game?
The what can we do is, you know, is something which comes out of the Protestant work ethic, you know, which is something that I have, you know, a terrible time dealing with. I would rather speak to what you can become as opposed to what you can do. I think that we have begged the question too long. Becoming what you are, you know, or becoming what you say you are, i.e. Christian, means a lot more than doing to me.
Yeah, I'll agree with you. Now, the second facet of this, could you define for us the wrong and the right connotations of black and Negro and some of the terms that are so often misused?
Well, we are black. We are not Negro or colored or nigger. We are black. Or we are Afro-American, you know, which is the same thing, usually. The word colored is a definition which white people drew up for us, as is the word Negro. That's a white definition of us. And it's sort of strange that white people, while they were calling us Negroes and using that Latin word to describe us, did not use Latin to define themselves as well. Otherwise, we would have had no problem, because we would have had Negroes and Blancos in this society, as opposed to Negroes and white people, you see. It's just that white people have been afraid of the dark, and they just could not say black, and they taught black people too to accept nothing other than watered down carbon copies of what they were, Negroes or colored.
Thank you. I don't feel the church is structured for people in it to become what they are. I think some congregations are becoming structured that way here and there in scattered places. I think you have the structure out here at Golden Village, but you don't have it in the average congregation.
Join the third world.
I would beg to differ that you've even got the structure at Holden Village, you see. Jim and I, and my wife and children, have sort of agreed that we're in a white world, very white. It's a world of Goldilockses and Alice in Wonderlands and other things, you know. It's a white world. So the structure isn't even here. The condition which people ought to be in, which obviously is one of conflict, is not presented here. Were it not for the bravery of one or two, you know, the conflict would not be here. I would suppose there could be a great deal of intellectualizing about the problem, which then reduces itself to a defining of the problem as something other than what it is. This infernal Negro problem in America, you know, the Indian problem, the Japanese or the Chinese problem, without ever getting to the point where we call it what it is. It is a white problem. We knew this. This is why we laughed at the Kerner report, you know, who said that white racism was the cause behind all of the trouble, but then goes on to describe what's wrong with black people, you know, and what can be done to help them, as opposed to dealing with what can be done to help white people, to understand white racism, their bondage to it, some to a greater extent than others. We have come to realize.
The use of this word oppression is interesting. When you began talking and using that word right away, I connected it with political and economic oppression. But I've been thinking now that it takes many forms, and oppression comes from many different areas. And I wonder, really, which one of us here in this room isn't in some way oppressed?
Oppressed? Well, I don't think that there are too many of us who are free of oppression, you see.
Right.
There are some, though. And there are some of us who have been plagued by overt oppressive forms, politically, religiously, you know, economically, socially.
There are many things in our culture which oppress.
Yeah. We can talk about oppression in other forms, and black people are terribly sensitive to that. The young in this society is oppressed, obviously. The women are oppressed, you know. Almost everybody is oppressed except those who have bought This Is a Man's World. Man, meaning white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, and someone who does not talk with an accent and, you know, and other things.
And I wouldn't
You wouldn't. That's right, Ludwig. You wouldn't fit. Yeah.
The thing that has taken Will a while to get through to me, in some respects, but the thing that I go here with is a sense of real terror and fear for the white church. I really wonder if there's any hope for a church that has wanted to embrace Christ and has embraced him, in fact, in many ways, an artificial Christ. But for this quote, white church that is identified so closely with the oppressor, this simply terrifies me.
It's a big fight between Bishop Myers, who was the Bishop of San Francisco, and Cardinal, now I drew a mental blank. But anyway, the Cardinal said that the war in Vietnam was Christ's war. It was a holy war. And so Bishop Myers then took him to task, you know, and said that the Christ you serve obviously is the Antichrist. One talks about warding off, if you will, and destroying godless, atheistic communism in the name of Christ. But we've somehow picked the wrong, you know, object. People who don't understand either system too well. And as one Vietnamese student said to me once, you know, Will, I don't know how y'all feel, but we feel as if we've got our Bibles between two huge bookends. You know, we feel as though there are two nuts with fingers poised over nuclear release buttons. You know, and in order to avoid getting at each other the way they should, because they know then that this, you know, is the eschaton, they would rather kill off us, you know, and feed from our flesh and our blood in order to supply the needs that they've got, bloodlust, among other things. You know, it's like Americans watching football games, and, you know, it's this sort of thing. And when the scores, as Ludwig was pointing out this morning, are tabulated, you know, certain words are, and you know, certain figures are used, you know. I mean, you think that you're watching a baseball game when you watch the evening news. So many for us and so many for them. And the use of the words moderate and light, you know. We inflicted heavy casualties upon them. Their casualties upon us were moderate to light. You didn't use that one, you know, moderate to light. You know, how do you get at that one? Or light to moderate, you know. Yeah. So this, and I too am terrified by Western Christianity as she presents herself now. And I think that this forces me back to the Bible and to an understanding of Jesus that's always been there. And that's where we went, some 40 of us who are now doing a thing called Introduction to Black Theology. And we figure we've got to do the whole thing over again, including the doctrine of man and the doctrine of eschatology, if you will. Clear through again. Basically because, you know, Martin Luther's catechism, question number 103, answer 103, ain't going to get it for us. It just ain't going to get it. Too difficult. Much too complex. Takes a theologian to understand that.
Maybe the church is going to be forced into the priesthood of all believers. I think this has happened in some places. One church in Dallas, Oregon, instead of having a traditional worship service and so on, now they cut that off, I believe, entirely, except for Communion Sunday. And first 20 minutes or so, they have their order of worship and 10-12 minute sermonette. then they break up into groups of a dozen high school students and groups of 12, too. And then the first 8 grades go to Sunday school classes. For about 40, 45 minutes, they have dialogue in these small groups. And they come back into the nave for reports. And concluding the service, it all lasts about an hour and a half. And something's really happened to that.
They'll let the kids come into that adult discussion, too.
What do you do?
I said they should.
Oh.
You see, Lutherans, and this is why I said this before already, white Lutheran heroes, one or two, you know? And the one which preserved my sanity while I was in jail down south was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You see, that's my hero. He's not read too much in these circles. And if he's read, he's not understood. There's going to be a play about him later on this week. You know, but I wonder how many people will enjoy, you know, as opposed to understanding. What it is that possesses a man like Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Well, it's the spirit. And it could get you killed. You know, not could, it will. And there are several forms of death that we talk about here, too, see? Death, social ostracism, as I see it, for white people, is a fate worse than death. They just don't want that. There's a run with the pack mentality and a reference group mentality which we see white people as needing. Well, you are.
A general statement that white people are the way you say they are.
White people fear social ostracism.
Pretty generally true.
I think
I think this is true. The thing that I'm most familiar with is a missionary, say an Indian, who wants to do something different, who go along with an Indian who wants to do away with the liturgy that has come from Norway 100 years ago, will be ostracized. I mean, there are things within the church, of course, and it's true that many of us lack courage to do anything because it means bread and butter, but it's true that our Christianity will have to revert back not into churches, but we will be meeting in homes someplace with the true Christian spirit. If the symbol of the church building with its wax floors and cushioned pew speaks of nothing but coldness and materialism, then it has to go.
But, you know, the revolution that's taking place, Will talked about social ostracism. A gentleman the other day I was talking to was talking about how economics right now might forcing out of a job at Boeing. But there's another kind of an economic pressure that takes place when you become part of the revolution. At a university situation, you're asked to leave, you know, any job situation, or when things get too uptight at church, you know, so you have to go underground. And these are some of the questions that my wife and I have been asking ourselves, and I think everyone should. Where are you going? And can you really identify yourself with the church that you belong to right now? Or the job you belong to? If that's how you identify yourself.
You can't identify yourself, but leaving an answer how will it get changed if you don't pay like what you believe in?
Well, sometimes you can't do it where you're at, you know?
One question asked in that kind of a thing is to really honestly ask whether you are bringing about the change that you idealize in your mind. You know, for instance, my wife taught last year in a, you know, just a suburb one step out of New Haven, you know, very racist, overtly racist, what I would call just middle class, typical middle class suburbia, although that's a general statement too. But I think it does have connote some kind of values and ideals. And so we had to ask the question whether next year she would go back, you know, and try to make some kind of a witness within her eighth grade art class, or whether she was going to quit that job and leave herself wide open to whatever may come about. And being honest, there was no way that we could see staying in that school and making any changes at all on anybody. Partly because of the psychological impact it has on the person who works there. I mean, when you're in a system that is very demanding that you step into line, you either start bending toward that line or they really, you get booted out. And before we had made the decision for sure whether she'd come back or not, we made some of our ideas known to school. And it became very obvious then what our choice had to be, just because of the reaction of the people in the school. And so I would say that, you know, if you have this thing about staying where I am and being a missionary to my people, this is fine if you can honestly answer the question that you're getting the job done that you want done, and that that's where you can really get it done most effectively.
You see, I long for the day when some white person, free from white hang-ups, free from having embraced comfortableness in Christianity, free from all of the guilt complexes which obviously fill any room anytime you get more than no black people, you know, do something on the beauty of whiteness and on white power, the latent potential good of it. But you see, I think that there's nothing on the horizon at this point that shows me that white folks are ready to do that, because white folks are constantly running away from asking the question, who am I? And they're always defining themselves in terms of who they are not. I am not black. I am not poor. I am not young. You know, I am not. I am not. I am not. Constantly I get this. I am not the way you say I am. You know, well then, for God's sake, you know, say who you are. Who are you? Tell me about yourself. Now, don't tell me about George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or some of the other bigots in your history, because that's what they were, bigots, you see. Check out Abraham Lincoln and you'll see that he was a bigot. You know, all of his writing betray that, you know. Once you get past the Gettysburg Address, then you're in trouble with Lincoln, because he relegates black people to a socially inferior position and says that his whole purpose was not to free black people, because he believed that they ought to be slaves, but his purpose was to preserve the Union, to preserve this false dignity which white folks had and which they have held on to for all of these years. It's a false dignity. It's a dignity which is tied into, as we see it on television and in other places, Lady Clairol commercials and Helena Rubinstein ones, Miss America contests, and other things which are repulsive even to most sensible white people. So, you know, if it is a generalization, you know, then break the generalization pattern for me.
I go along with that. You've been telling us what we say we are not. Do the black people, by the same token, have this kind of creed of knowing who they are?
No, I've been told who I am not, you see.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Which then forced me into discovering who I was.
Because you know who you are, would you go along with the idea that perhaps the person who is being oppressed in the overall picture is not the black but the white? He doesn't know who he is.
Martin King used to say that all the time, but white folk never believed him. You know, he used to say that the prisoner is in fact in prison.
We call it hang-up.
Yeah.
As opposed to oppression.
Except that this is not oppression, you know. It's like going to church on Sundays, you know. Being white is a comfort station until somebody invades and violates the sanctity of that whiteness. There is certainly a feeling of oppression, you know, which comes with certain guilt complexes which are created, you know. Any competent psychoanalyst would agree with that, you know. But except the defenses, you know, that go up are defenses which are symbolic of the oppressor and not the oppressed.
But there are many diseases, for example, that involve a progressive deterioration of nerves or lack of sensitivity.
Yeah, you know, black people have been presented as the oppressed people. Moynihan did that. Anybody familiar with Moynihan? He's now the expert on black people. Nixon appointed him, you see, because he did this little study, you know. And one of the big things that Moynihan dealt with was a thing called familial deterioration, you know, the breakup of the black family, you see, you know, how bad that is. Well, some of us are doing studies now on familial deterioration in white communities. And we are saying that white people are culturally deprived. They are culturally deprived. Deprived in the sense that, culturally, in the sense that that they are in a white ghetto, spiritually and physically, white ghetto. A world that's not for real. A world that's somehow tied into the things that I've described, which are not for real. Black people realize, as we do in our family, that Marty and Kathy and Stephen, these are our children, if they were to grow up in an all-black community, go to an all-black school, play with, you know, all-black playmates, worship in an all-black church, perhaps die and be buried in an all-black cemetery, and wind up in an all-black heaven, you know, then that kind of God we've got to reject, you see. We can't live with that kind of God. Marty says, when he saw the two or three black children that came in here with the Martys, you know, hey, Dad, you know that there are five of us here now. Well, no, son, there are more than five of us. You know, there are seven of us. Your mother and I count, don't we? No, you don't, because you're big people. But there are five black children here now. And then he says, I don't mind playing with white children, but not all the time. Not all the time. At 6 1/2, he is terribly aware of the contradictions built into this society, and the contradictions still presented on television yet, you know, except for the one or two who gets their teeth whiter than white, you know, or who gets splashed with water, you know, and the curls fall out. Preposterous, you know. You know, I might fit into that category more than some of my brothers and sisters, you know, because my hair is, it's sort of a cross between y'all's and theirs, like, you know, like the person is, Herzfeld, obviously, you know. Means a field of hearts, by the way. Ludwig Herzfeld, you know, field of hearts, which I think says something about the man. I've even started to take my name a little more seriously than I used to, understanding German a little bit, you know. But then, if it were not for the fact that I took it so seriously, I would name my name. I would name myself Will X. You see, and reject. How did I get the name? Well, I got it honestly, because my great grandfather was from Herzfeld, Germany. Yeah. Sort of interesting that I was able to chase that part of my ancestry back to Herzfeld, Germany, almost immediately, you know. But it took me a number of years to find my black ancestry and to chase it back to Kenya, you see. Which again is, you know, sort of an example of the frustration that some of us had finding out who we were, if you will.
Would you comment on Will X?
Yeah, if I had called myself Will X, I think I'd be in the same trouble that Muhammad Ali is in right now. You know, Muhammad Ali could lick John Wayne anytime he wanted to. You know, he could just beat hell out of John Wayne. Everybody knows that. But John Wayne can change his name and people forget who he was. Or Marilyn Monroe or Liz Taylor. You know, pick one, you know. But check out the center folds of any sports page or sports magazine. They insist on calling him Cassius Clay. Which then makes for some problem for him because the man is trying desperately to communicate. While people are tuning him out psychologically. You know, they refuse to accept him as he is. But they have no problem with John Wayne. These are the contradictions which we must point out, you see. And the contradictions even worse than that, because the whole history of the country is a contradiction, the way the words are used, etc. We're going to talk more about that later on in the week, you know. We'll probably get into some real contradictions when we talk maybe tonight about sex and racism. That's a real doozer. That can separate the men from the boys. Or the boys from the girls. And maybe the men from the women.
I think about this thing you said, who am I, you know, the old cliche. I got a hang up on about words are really nothing, but what you do is everything. It's just, you know. So it all goes back to, I can't. No, I don't you see. What you are speaks so loud that I can't hear what you see. You know? Did I have any bearing on that?
Yeah, one of the reasons why I don't, you know, enter into any elongated rhetoric about who I am is that folks ought to be able to see. You know. And it's something that you don't have to figure out anymore. You know, it's something that you know by seeing. And you know, I'm not opposed to being felt, you know? Touch me and see. You know, I'm not even opposed to being smelt. I was about to say that's sort of fishy, you know.
Yeah. I teach in a interracial school, and I find that the Negroes with white mothers have as much a problem with the race as the all blacks.
That used to be a real big problem. some of us were too white to be black and too black to be white. You see? And this was, you know, this was a part of our frustration. We were told by white people that you're not good enough. And we were conversely told by black people, you're too good. You know, you're too good to be black. So we had to accept, if you will, the whole sociological dash anthropological schema, which this country came up with some years ago. If you've got one one-hundredth of one one-hundredth, one-tenth percent black blood in you, you are black. You know. They did that in Germany too, didn't they, Ludwig? That's the way they did it, because the master race somehow had to avoid and so we, you know, America, you know, the Europeans and others followed the same general line, which is pretty much like the Austrian on a soapbox mentality, which some of us are repulsed by, you know, in Nazi Germany. Now, when some of us say that this country is fast becoming a neo-fascist state, you have to understand the context in which we say that. You see, the neo-fascism did not start with the cries for law and order today. And it's sort of interesting that young folks have picked up the quotes of people like Ronald Reagan, and Nixon, and others, and they sound exactly like the sounds that Hitler made. Read that, and then read some of the law and order statements and see if they are not alike. Hitler, for example, used this one, Ludwig, help me on this one, because I don't want to misquote him. We are being overrun by... How did he describe the college students? We're being overrun by, you know, ne'er-do-wells, you know, anarchists, you know, our universities and our societies being threatened, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We have no other alternative except to put them down. And we must put them down. We must have law and order. But you see, the strange thing is that these men would indicate to me that they were different if they were to just utter one little word, blacks and browns and reds and yellows and the young would like to hear. Justice. Justice. But you don't hear that. Lots of talk about law and order, however, but none about justice.
Well, I'm going to be on that bus for this gentleman too, I guess, later on, so I...
Those of you who are going, interrupt me.
Myself, yeah. Running out of time, I'm...
It's later than we all think.
That's right. Well, I feel this way, that it's fine to have open confrontation with you here, on the intellectual, but I wish I would have the opportunity that maybe you could bring with you some of the Christians that your church, any community you can think of, a cross-section like we represent here, where we can have this open confrontation and really get to know each other, feel, touch,
and
this type of thing. That's the only way that I know that I have a better feeling toward my classmates where I'm going to school at Pepperdine in the LA area. My company is eventually going to have 80% black people in their company because that's where you're located.
I don't want to evoke any sympathy from you. Nor do I want to put Jim on the spot here, but I think that Jim and I both agree that the young blacks wouldn't be caught dead in this place, would they, Jim?
No. Yeah.
They will not come. They figure that it's already too late. They don't want to take the time to be subjected to harassment, you know, and overt oppression forms, and they don't want to kill anybody. You see? And so they stay away. And so they'll ask me when I get back to the block, Will, what you been doing for 3 weeks? I've been up in Holden Village. Any blacks up there? Yeah, one. How old were they? Well, I'll say one young one came in. What did he say to you? I'll say, well, he kept reminding, he kept asking me if I had ulcers and why don't I, you know, resort to the language that the folks use to communicate. How can you stand it, you know? And they'll say, well, Will, you had a good time, you know. And then they'll start understanding why I'm grabbing them off the streets to try and get a little refurbishing, you see. It's terribly debilitating. And you have to understand why it is. It's debilitating basically because not enough of you all are willing to do what needs to get done. That's all. Not enough of you have the intestinal fortitude at this point. But you watch the ones who walk into the village and you listen to the ones who are talking here. They're not simply agreeing with me. They are, I think, folks who have become increasingly aware of their isness and of who they are, and they want to communicate. That's why I still can come. Now somehow I must convince my black brothers and sisters out there that they too must come, but I ain't going to try too hard right now. Because black folks have got a thing to do, namely getting themselves together, and they cannot take the time, very simply. They can't take the time.
Well, being that Christians, too, as we feel we are here, I don't feel that we're that far apart as that line that you put up there shows. But we have no way of knowing until we try and test it through confrontation.
That's right. Conflict. It's if it's creative, it's good. And I believe in that.